From PRI and WNYC, this is the podcast of Studio 360, Public Radio's premier program about creativity, pop culture, and the arts, hosted by Kurt Anderson. This podcast is a segment of the hour-long program, which can be heard weekly on public radio stations across America. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. For his 22nd novel, John Updike could have stuck to one of his well-established fictional templates: upper-middle-class marriage or middle-aged angst, sex or parenthood or the writing life, maybe set somewhere in leafy New England. Instead, in his new novel, the main character is a half-Egyptian teenager in New Jersey who is mesmerized by radical Islam. The book is set just after 9/11. It's called Terrorist, and it's now a bestseller. John Updike, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you. Lovely to be here.
We seem to be in a season, your book chief among them, of 9/11 novels, essentially. Were you reluctant to join in that bandwagon?
It's, I guess, predictable that there would be a surge. The event has taken a while to digest. I mean, things don't immediately turn up in novels, although I wrote a short story about the events of 9/11 fairly soon, maybe too soon after the thing. And now we are getting, yes, novels. I even read one of them with the long, unmemorable title by Jonathan Safran Foer, in which the absent father left messages increasingly panicky on the family answering machine. What a wonderful image, isn't it? I suppose it really happened, too. It could certainly have happened. The whole thing, the gallantry, really, of the doomed people, caring about your family in that condition of imminent death, almost boggles the mind, and you hesitate to approach the tender wound, the still tender wound of it. So I don't have much 9/11, but they do allude to it. They do go and view the vanished towers, and my particular people in the conversation say it's how nice it is that they're gone, which is an unkind, maybe, thing to say.
You have, for almost 50 years now in your fiction, been depicting American family breakdowns and the sort of ugliness of American materialism and moral flabbiness. Your main character in The Terrorist, Ahmad, is also appalled by all those things and kind of an idealist. Did you find yourself sympathizing at some point with his take on the great Satan?
Yes, he's a hero who's sympathetic, to me at least. I wouldn't have created one that I dislike. He certainly puts things in an extreme fashion, and he frames it all in terms of the Islamic vision of purity. I think purity is maybe not within our capacity. We shouldn't be striving too hard for purity. But yeah, a lot of his perceptions are shared by me and by other characters in the book.
As you were constructing this character, was it different, easier, harder than the usual process you go through to create a character who is nothing like you?
He is not very talkative. He has these internal thought streams, which are partly imbibed from the more fluent and mature imam, who has clearly given him the line on radical Islam. And when he talks, when Ahmad talks, there's a kind of a stateliness, a laconic quality, which my characters don't always have. But I learned to live with that, and it must be a quality that I impose, thinking that such a boy would be laconic, reserved, very much his own man, his own package somehow.
Well, before we go any further, if you could read maybe from the beginning of Terrorist, I'd appreciate it.
Yes, so this is my 18-year-old hero looking at the high school around him. Devils, Ahmad thinks, these devils seek to take away my God. All day long at Central High School, girls sway and sneer and expose their soft bodies and alluring hair. Their bare bellies, adorned with shining navel studs and low-down purple tattoos, ask, what else is there to see? Boys strut and saunter along and look dead-eyed, indicating with their edgy killer gestures and careless, scornful laughs that this world is all there is, a noisy varnished hall lined with metal lockers and having at its end a blank wall desecrated by graffiti and roller painted over so often it feels to be coming closer by millimeters. The teachers, weak Christians and unobservant Jews make a show of teaching virtue and righteous self-restraint, but their shifty eyes and hollow voices betray their lack of belief. They are paid to say these things by the city of New Prospect and the state of New Jersey. They lack true faith. They are not on the straight path. They are unclean. Ahmad and the 2,000 other students can see them scuttling after school into their cars on the crackling, trash-speckled parking lot, like pale crabs or dark ones restored to their shells. And they are men and women like any others, full of lust and fear and infatuation with things that can be bought. Infidels, they think safety lies in accumulation of the things of this world and in the corrupting diversions of the television set. They are slaves to images, false ones of happiness and affluence. But even true images are sinful imitations of God who can alone create.
John Updike reading from his new novel, Terrorist. Did you have a different sense of empathy or sympathy with Ahmad when you began and when you ended?
Yes, he does change in the course of the novel, though it's this position, if that's what this passage expresses, is absolute. Nevertheless, he is himself human and impure. And I meant to show a gradual, perceptible growing up, as it were, growing up out of youthful idealism and absolutism into a kind of humanity. So in that sense, the book has a happy ending.
Even critics who give you a hard time for particular books never fail to grant that you are our great, exquisite, virtuosic prose craftsman. So that clearly seems to be part of what will be your legacy. And another part, it seems to me, will be, oh, he's among other things, he brought explicit descriptions of sex into serious mainstream fiction. How do you feel about that part of the legacy?
The sex part, it's mm-hmm. true enough. I did make a kind of deliberate effort. I did feel that the sexual realism was basically lacking in the novel as the Victorians handled it. And even the great Russians don't have much explicit sex, but you certainly are sexy. You feel the sex in Tolstoy, but you never see it described. And others have described it, of course, Lawrence and Joyce famously in the Molly Bloom soliloquy and Henry Miller in the famous Olympia Press. You know, there were other precedents, but to do it in a novel that would be sold at the corner bookstore was perhaps new. Rabbit Run contained a couple scenes when he first meets Ruth and they go to bed together. That was described maybe more fully than enough. Fully enough, in fact, that a lawyer was called in and I sat with him and deleted a few phrases that he thought Southern sheriffs might object to. And as it turned out, Southern sheriffs had other fish to fry and the book was never prosecuted, but there was that danger. But again, I thought the sex is something that happens between human beings. Their personalities go into the bed as well. So all that deserved description. I'm not sure I was the best person to do it, but since I wrote Couples, a lot of people have done just that. A lot of female writers have given us the woman's point of view of the sex act or sex act. So, yeah, in some sense, I was a little pioneer, tiny pioneer.
But also there was a sense that you were unabashed about liking it.
Yes, well, you can't. Doesn't everybody like it? And certainly I liked describing it, and even in as chaste and severe a book as Terrorist has a couple of sex scenes that kind of warmed me up. I mean, yes, you must see these people behaving. This is a strange thing we do. Very strange when you think of our brains and all the abstraction they're capable of, that nevertheless we are all prey to these terrible urges, irresistible urges, and you risk your wallet, your virginity, you risk your social position, all this for sex. You began by talking about the way I'm viewed as a competent stylist in spite of the bad use I make of it. That complaint has been issued right from the start. Norman Podoretz, who at that time was a very prominent critic, disliked The Poor House Fair and the short stories because it was all flash and glimmer and where's the substance. In my mind, there was substance there, and I wasn't especially trying to write beautifully. I was just trying to write accurately is how I construed it.
You can't help but write beautifully.
Well, I certainly do a lot of fussing with the stuff. And I'm very aware of watching my own brain slowly disintegrate. So I look at the prose extra hard to see if it's
really
beginning to feel senile.
At 70, that's a different thing, a part of the process, than it was at 60 or 50?
I seem to be aware, maybe abnormally and unhealthily aware, of aging as something that's going to happen unless I abruptly die. And one of the reasons I want to
let the listeners know that he's grinning as he's saying this thing.
But it's a grim grin. No, I'm grinning, of course, because I'm not going to die at this moment, and I'm pleased about that. But I don't know. I don't know what to say about the whole thing of aging. I have nothing in my mind for a next novel, although I don't want to quit quite yet, and hopes that one will emerge.
Well, good luck, and thank you, John Updike, very much.
Thank you.
John Updike's 22nd novel is in bookstores right now. And while you're waiting for the 23rd, you can find out more about Mr. Updike and his work at our website, studio360.org. Unlike when I was young, the stigma of taking recreational drugs or admitting you take them is huge. You just don't do it. Except this drug. Caffeine is about the last non-prescription drug you can use without any social stigma. And in fact, millions of us are now obsessed with the finer points of getting it. Corby Kummer is definitely one of those. He's a professional foodie, writing about luscious cheeses and perfect butter and esoteric pork for the Atlantic Monthly, as well as a book called The Joy of Coffee. Today in Design for the Real World, Corby Kummer tells us about a brewing device that he thinks is now due for a revival.
I started researching coffee in the mid-1980s, and it was a time of enormous ferment and revival. Mom and pops every place, kids studying in locally owned coffee shops everywhere you went.
Yeah, it's nice and hot.
Electric drip coffee is everybody's way of making coffee, and I think it's because they just want to turn the sink on and push a button. It seems great. It's like having an extra stove. It's a whole appliance. It's a whole system, and it keeps it warm. It ruins it while it's keeping it warm. It boils it. It turns it this horrible, acrid, disgusting-smelling brew. But in America, the idea is there's always something for the guests when they come in. And thinking that if you have a sophisticated new coffee maker, you are offering your family and your guests the best. It's hard to think of a completely foolproof coffee brewing system that at 7 in the morning takes out every decision from your mind. But if you're looking in the 30s and the 40s at what the ultimate streamlined, fabulous coffee maker was, it was the vacuum coffee maker. Now, that sounds like it's crazy. Why would I want to vacuum my coffee? In fact, it's still my favorite way of making coffee. I call it the compact disc of coffees because it's absolutely clean. It's this pure, it's as if all of the hiss was removed. The only thing you taste is the absolute essence of coffee. It does work by vacuum. You pour hot water and coffee into the top globe of a double globe chamber, and the bottom globe has a vacuum seal, and the difference in temperature sucks that coffee down through a filter into that bottom chamber, and you've got strongly flavored, very heavily filtered coffee, so it's very pure. In the 1930s, this double globe method was in chromium steel, and it looked like $1 million. And I still collect these machines. I've got about 4 of them because they're so great looking, and I just keep one on my counter. They are symbols of the Bullitt Railroad. You know, they look like the great industrialized design, streamlined from the 30s and 40s. And in America, Amazingly enough, this great, what's now considered an abstruse, sophisticated, super four aficionados only method was diffuse in diners. It was made by a company called Silex, and it's still generically called the Silex method. But it was developed in Germany, and Bodum redid it for the 1990s in an offset clear plastic pot.
In the morning I wake up, cash cook brewing in my cup, it's coffee.
You know, it's undeniably sexy, the vacuum coffee press. When that mixture is whooshed down by vacuum and sucked through by force, you really feel almost cleansed.
And do you take cream or sugar?
Corby Kummer is the author of The Joy of Coffee. There's more on the vacuum coffee maker at studio360.org. Chris Roos produced our story. You are listening to Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. And speaking of stimulants and intoxicants of a stronger kind than coffee, David Berman helped define a style of indie rock called lo-fi, deliberately rough-sounding songs that sound like they were tossed off while recovering from a hangover.
Radio's on, feeling all right, cruising the strip on a Saturday night, smiling my way, and I hide all my pain, but the sign tonight.
Berman is Jewish, and in the early 90s, he started a band called the Silver Jews with his friend Stephen Malkmus. At the time, Malkmus was also fronting the big deal band Pavement. Berman kept a much lower profile. He continued to put out Silver Jews albums and in 1998 published a book of poetry. But he almost never performed live. He stayed home and tried to get by on fairly modest royalty payments. The vicissitudes of life, including a bad drug and alcohol habit, caught up with him. And now, in recovery, Berman is facing his fans for the first time in years.
My main goal in life when I was young was a negative one. It was that I not work for anyone. I feel strange about having my attention directed to anything other than the most wonderful thing that will be happening around me that day.
I'm scared, I swear, of you.
Me and two of my best friends moved to New York in 1989, 1990. We had made all these songs that we recorded in the apartment on a handheld Walkman, and it was just fun, you know, like three friends playing one-upmanship or something. We would sing, make up a song and sing, and I would sing a line, and then Steve would sing a line. And we had all these tapes of these fun nights.
Everybody smoked. Well, you can't say, that my soul has died away.
I still needed more time to figure out a way how not to work for other people. And my old professor from University of Virginia, Charles Wright, he said that I should think about going to get a master's degree at the University of Massachusetts to study with James Tate, his friend, a poet. So April came around, and I had sent off some poems that I'd written. They wrote back, and they said, well, we'd like you to come up here, and you don't have to pay for tuition. And I didn't even know, hadn't thought that was possible for me. So by the time the graduate school was over, I had done my first two records. From that point on, which was 10 years ago, I'd been able to support myself.
I had this friend, his name was Mark with a C. His sister was like the heat coming off the back of an old TV. The bitter folks were slain in their red boiling spring song. It was the worst of the Lord, some of the worst of the Lord.
you know, many, many years of successful drug use, I really got really bad in like 2002, 2003. I don't know why I did what I did that morning. When I woke up, when I figured out where I was and what I'd done and what had happened, my wife and my father were there. They asked me to do them a favor, to go to rehab. And I agreed, and I went. A year, 2 years ago, I got out of rehab and came out of there, and I was $50,000 in debt. The debt had come from drugs, from running credit card schemes that, I mean, it's unbelievable that I financially exist as an entity in the United States of America, but it'll take me a couple years to get out of it. The last Silver Jews record had been 3 years. Nobody was waiting for another one. You know, these shows with these people in it.
Hey guys, how are you doing?
They're really saving me.
Sorry it took so long to get here, and we're working with time on the cosmic scale. But I still have a problem remembering my songs, and it helps me to read them. So if you don't mind, I gotta read these while I play them. All right? All right?
No, I don't really wanna die.
It's very painful to know you're going out there and you're going to be serving up some flaws. As an artist who's like always had the ability and taken the opportunity to hold back my work until I felt like it was good enough to look at, it's extremely embarrassing. In the beginning, it was like, if it can't be my way, I won't do it. I think that's the sort of thing that is different about me now than before. And the former me was a quitter extraordinaire. And I think I showed that, you know, in just in attempting suicide.
Well, I probably don't have to tell you I have mixed feelings about this ritual, the encore ritual, but for you guys,
David Berman and his group, The Silver Jews, are headlining the Pitchfork Music Festival in Chicago next weekend. Jesse Dukes produced our story. Coming up, why are American poets like Billy Collins so excited by Emily Dickinson?
I've removed her tippet, of course, and then the gown of gossamer, that's got to go.
Is she naked at the end of this poem?
She's naked in the second stanza, yeah.
Sex and death, especially death, in Emily Dickinson. That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is made possible by Herman Miller and Design Within Reach, celebrating the 50th anniversary of the Eames lounge chair and ottoman, the 20th century interpretation of classic wood and leather lounge design. Product details are available online at dwr.com/360.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Emily Dickinson. Now, she is one of those writers who's as famous for the life as for the writing. So, for our series on American icons, we asked WBUR's Sean Cole, who's a poet himself, to take a closer look at Because I Could Not Stop for Death. It is about getting picked up by the Grim Reaper. For a high school English standby, it's a very strange work of art.
I started off by looking at the original. It It's at the Houghton Library at Harvard University. One of the curators, Leslie Morris, had it waiting for me in the Dickinson room.
It's under lock and key.
Well, you know,
the room is filled with stuff that actually belonged to Dickinson, stuff that was important to her.
She wrote at that table?
She wrote at that table and in that chair.
Oh, my God.
Emily Dickinson is a poetry prophet. You hear all the time that she was a modernist before modernism and a surrealist before surrealism. And yet, I never thought Because I Could Not Stop for Death was that great an example of what she could do. It seemed too high school-y, too obvious and archetypal. But seeing the thing she wrote with her hand, it was like looking at some sacred lost scroll.
Could you possibly read the poem?
Would you mind reading it?
Sure. No, I mean, no.
Because I could...
All right, ready?
Because I could not stop for death.
He kindly stopped for me.
The carriage, but just ourselves.
And immortality.
We slowly drove. He knew no haste.
And I had put away my labor and my leisure too.
For his civility.
We passed the school where children strove.
At recess in the ring.
We passed the fields of gazing grain.
We passed the setting sun.
Or rather, he passed us.
The dews drew quivering and chill.
For only gossamer my gown.
My tippet only tulle.
We paused before a house that seemed a swelling of the ground.
The roof was scarcely visible.
The cornice in the ground.
Since then, 'tis centuries.
And yet feel shorter than the day.
I first surmised the horse's heads.
Or toward eternity. Wonderful poem, isn't it?
It's perfect, really, that Dickinson should write from the perspective of someone who's already died. No one heard Dickinson's true voice until after her death, and she weirdly seems to have planned for posthumous fame. For example, when the poems were discovered in the Bureau, about 900 of them, including Because I Could Not Stop for Death, were neatly copied out into 40 hand-bound booklets. Leslie Morris let me hold the piece of string Dickinson used to bind one of them.
Oh, my God. I've never been so enthralled by holding a piece of string before.
I was so thrilled I told my friend Joseph about it. Like, I'm like practically crying over a piece of dirty string.
Well,
that I'm holding
in my hand.
It
wasn't just any piece of dirty string.
It wasn't just any piece of dirty string. Joseph Leese, is chair of the MFA program in writing at California College of the Arts and a celebrated poet himself. He's the one who first turned me on to how radical Dickinson was for her time, which is why she's so much more popular now than a lot of other 19th century American poets, he says.
You, if you ask Americans, you know, well, you've read some poetry in school. Who do you love? Americans don't say, oh, I love Longfellow. Boy, I mean, some of them do. Longfellow has his fans. But
come hither, my little daughter, and do not tremble so, for I can weather the roughest gale that ever wind did blow.
Henry Wadsworth Longfellow was part of a whole windy gang known as the Fireside Poets. They wrote long Midnight Ride of Paul Revere-type macho verse, poetry with a capital P. It was Dickinson's little p, her plain spokenness and economy, that helped usher American poetry into its next era. She could worm through to the same huge issues, death, beauty, love, using a fraction of the words, in a meter so common.
It's called common meter, usually. Yeah, it's da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da.
This is Billy Collins, former U.S. Poet Laureate.
Da-da-da-da-da-da. That 4-3 meter, it's the meter of the hymn, as everyone knows. It's also the meter of nursery rhymes. Old King Cole was a merry old soul, and a merry old soul was he. Same exact rhythm.
A rhythm that can sound kind of repetitive to younger readers of Dickinson these days.
I'm in this writing class right now, and one of the first days we got there, there was a group of people sitting in the corner just bashing her.
Jenny Proctor is a senior at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. When she was in high school, she started an Emily Dickinson fan club that no one joined. Now that she's in college, things haven't gotten much better.
They're like, you can sing her songs to the tune of...
Gilligan's Island.
Yes, Gilligan's Island. Thank you. You know, and they were singing along and laughing, and, you know, I didn't join in or anything.
Because I could not stop for death, he kindly stopped for me.
You know, I tried to stand up for her, and I'm just like, you know, hey, she did it beautifully. You know, I'd like to see you try that.
To achieve such linguistic originality within that little dance, the very conservative little structure of that meter is part of her wonderment.
There's a kind of, and this is a big theme in the Dickinson literature, the lack of reference in her language.
This is Robert Howard. He's studied the Dickinson literature at length and written articles on her work.
Take the example of gazing grain. What is gazing grain? I mean, you might think grazing grain, but, you know, it sounds absolutely right, but there's no way really to know what it means.
We passed the fields of gazing grain. We passed the setting sun.
The thing is, you don't have to know what it means. Dickinson understood, innately, that something could feel true without having to make literal sense. No one else was playing with words like that at the time. Walt Whitman was just as radical, but in a totally opposite, declarative, celebratory way. And in any case, Dickinson never read him. Said she heard he was scandalous.
This is Emily Dickinson's bedroom.
Dickinson's house is about three blocks from the center of Amherst, Mass. It's a museum now. Cindy Dickinson showed me around. She's the director of programming and interpretation.
And I am not related to Emily Dickinson.
That's so funny.
A lot of people think of Dickinson as having been holed up in this house her whole life. But for about 15 years of it, she lived down the street.
The other house looked out over the town cemetery. And many scholars speculate that one reason she wrote using funerals, cemeteries as imagery, is that that was her experience. I mean, it was right next door. So they were her neighbors, in essence. So that is...
The dead were her neighbors.
The dead, yes, right.
And now she's buried in that cemetery.
Born December 10th, 1830. Called back May 15th, 1886.
Dickinson used that little phrase, called back, in the last letter she ever wrote, a letter to her cousins to tell them she was dying. It read, in its entirety, "Little cousins, called back, Emily." Again, she was concise. But if you're called back, there must be a caller, which might be why death seems so comforting in a lot of her poems. Joseph Lease.
I think one of the ways that "Because I Could Not Stop for Death" really speaks to contemporary readers, I think when the dead speak in a poem, when a posthumous voice speaks, it answers one of our deepest needs. We hope that there's a heaven, and not just a heaven, but a heaven where you're still yourself, where there's still a sense of personal agency.
Because I could not stop for death, he kindly stopped for me.
About 14 years ago, Emily Dickinson came back to life on late-night radio in Boston. A woman named Belinda West portrayed her a few times on WGBH's Night Air, and she's still playing Dickinson at schools and various events. I thought talking to her might be the closest I could get to talking to the poet herself. Except, what do you ask Emily Dickinson?
Were you lonely?
Sir, we've hardly met. Are you lonely?
You never feel quite so small as when Emily Dickinson gives you a hard time.
And why don't you seek to publish more?
Fame is a bee. It has a song, it has a sting, and all too, it has a wing.
That's a whole Dickinson poem, actually, just those four lines.
This business of submitting material to those who only change its form entirely and its meaning as well, why seek that? It's the auction of the mind.
And Belinda's citing another poem there. The full quote is, "Publication is the auction of the mind of man." Dickinson published 11 poems while she was alive, all of them anonymously. No one saw "Because I Could Not Stop for Death" until it was put out in a volume of her work, 4 years after her actual death. And even then, no one saw the whole poem. The editors on that first posthumous collection cut out the fourth stanza.
"We passed the setting sun, or rather he passed us. The dews drew quivering and chill for only gossamer my gown, my tippet only tulle."
This is a total mystery. My best guess is that they thought Dickinson was too scantily clad in her gown of gossamer. Anyway, it wasn't until 1955 that the full version of the poem was published. And over the years, certain poets have gotten pretty excited about that gown of gossamer part, if you know what I mean.
I was taking my clue from that stanza.
This is Billy Collins again. He's talking about the title poem of one of his books. It's called "Taking Off Emily Dickinson's Clothes."
I remove her tippet, of course, and then the gown of gossamer, that's got to go.
Is she naked at the end of this poem?
She's naked in the second stanza, yeah.
Collins wrote the poem, he says, because he was tired of this one particular thread in Dickinsonian scholarship, the question of her sexuality, whether she was gay or not. He calls it unprofitable gossip.
And that was the frustration I experienced when I decided to write Taking Off Emily Dickinson's Clothes and have sex with her.
So you have sex with her in the poem?
Yes.
You dog, you.
Well, grr. Rough.
Collins's poem is one of about 80, collected in a whole anthology of tributes to Dickinson. Her influence is renewed with every generation of writers. Again, Joseph Lees.
The gorgeous music and amazing rhythmical control in her work are there in a number of contemporary poets, and that's something that inspires me deeply. I feel like I tune my ear by reading her poetry aloud, and you know, along with other poets as well, of course, but always her, always returning to her.
Because I would not stop for death, he kindly stopped for me.
And musicians keep returning to her too. This poem has been scored at least 5 times, including this version by Aaron Copland and 3 folk versions.
We slowly drove in you no haste,
and I had put away
my labor and my leisure too for his civility.
In fact, the poem is so iconic, it's been spoofed in newspaper columns. The one in the Denver Rocky Mountain News turned it into a story about a skiing accident.
Because I could not stop for breath, it kindly stopped for me. We'd both been going awfully fast until I hit a tree.
Maybe this is why Dickinson rejected the very idea of fame, at least while she was around to experience it. One time, in a letter to a friend who was critical of her work, Dickinson wrote, "I smile when you suggest that I delay to publish, that being foreign to my thought as firmament to fin. If fame belonged to me, I could not escape her." For Studio 360, I'm Sean Cole.
You can find out more about Emily Dickinson and Because I Could Not Stop for Death and about all the American icons that we've explored on the show at studio360.org. I'm Kurt Anderson, and I want to thank you for listening to Studio 360 today and express my fondest hope that you'll join us again for next week's show. Studio 360 is produced by WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Julie Burstein,
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Ave Carrillo,
Derek John,
Sarah Lilly,
Eric Malinsky,
Ada Birnier,
Monica Carrier,
Evan Rose.
And the theme music is by David Van Tegum.
Studio 360 is funded in part by Ken and Lucy Lehman, supporting CARE in its efforts to alleviate global poverty. On the web at care.org. The Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. Studio 360's American Icons Project is made possible in part by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities, Great Ideas Brought to Life.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I've always loved the definition of writers as shy megalomaniacs.
My physique is not so wonderful, and yet I love to, in a sense, metaphorically speaking, take my shirt off and bare my chest and maybe beat it a little bit.
Hey, I'd like to see you try it.
I'm Kurt Anderson, the author of Absurdistan. Gary Steingart joins me next time in Studio 360 from PRI.
You've been listening to a segment from PRI's Studio 360. If you'd like to hear the show in its entirety, visit studio360.org to find out when the program is broadcast on your public radio station. Studio 360's podcast is supported by Herman Miller and Design Within Reach, working together to foster a greater appreciation of authentic modern designs for the home.